From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our call, some interesting topics to talk about?
Yes, we're going to talk about the new nutrition labels that the FDA is discussing, along with the president, the importance and where we stand on that. And then caramel coloring is linked to high levels of cancer. And what does this mean? Is it really linked? How strong
that's
is the link?
That's the coloring in the soda.
Soda, some of the coloring in sodas. But what does it really mean? Is it really meaningful? What does it mean to you if you drink a lot of soda?
And tell us about the yummy tofu recipe.
It's wonderful. It's luscious. It's delicious. It's fragrant. It's got just the texture you like. It sort of tastes like sirloin steak on the grill, medium rare. We call it tofu.
Yeah, tofu, I'd stumble over it too.
I almost said tofu, meaning a combination of terrible and tofu. But it's tofu stir fry. For those of you who like tofu at all, this is one recipe you're going to want to watch and listen to. And maybe Tom will actually taste. I don't know. Possible.
Maybe so. Maybe not. 800-462-7413, toll free. Before we get to the phones, Zorba, let's talk about me.
Talk about you.
I, as you know, have kind of a killer cold. I've had it for 2.5 weeks,
yes.
3 weeks.
Yes.
No fever, just a lot of drainage and hacking. Hacking. So I called just the other day my, public radio's favorite family doc, and he prescribed to me an antibiotic and some cough medicine, which I found out has codeine.
That's right.
Why the antibiotic? Because you don't usually suggest antibiotics for colds.
Right. Well, first of all, we have to look at the science of medicine, and then we have to look at the art of medicine. So scientifically, most likely you have a viral infection. But what I find as a family doc is when people have had this for 3 weeks, you've had it for how long? Almost 3 weeks?
Yeah, about 3 weeks.
About 3 weeks. They call up. They often have post-nasal drip. They have drainage. So the 3 weeks is a very important part of it, because when people call up my office, speak to myself or one of my partners or one of my nurses, and they say, well, I have drainage for a couple of days. We never prescribe antibiotics, almost never. Unless they've got a fever over 101.5 and they have other risk factors, then we might do it. But more often than not, we actually have them come in the office and see them. But what I've learned is that after 3 weeks, it becomes a different issue. And so quite often, I often will prescribe an antibiotic because maybe there's a bacterial overgrowth from the viral infection.
Got it.
And it usually starts with a virus. Didn't sound to me like influenza because you didn't have the high fever that's often associated
with it.
Worthwhile. Now, the reason is you might have a bacterial infection of your sinuses. The other thing is you are coughing and hacking. So codeine cough syrup, well, what's the risk of that? Well, codeine can constipate you. That's a big risk in there, especially as you get older, constipation is a risk. But sometimes the codeine is just useful, stops that desire, that hacky feeling. And if you're not engaged in an activity where you can't be a little inebriated by the codeine, it's okay to take.
Now, the pharmacist said I should take one teaspoon
of this. One teaspoon.
It's very difficult. You can't to put the codeine in a teaspoon and get it just to the top with again get it to your mouth without spilling it. So what I did was take a tablespoon and put it about half full.
Well, that's about 7.5 cc's. That's about a teaspoon and a half. For codeine cough syrup, it's really not going to be a bother. What I was glad
that I did after the tablespoon, I just took it out of the bottle.
That's what I was going to say.
This is about a teaspoon.
Inevitably, what I think a lot of people do, they go, I can't get this teaspoon. I'll drink it directly out of the bottle and do that. Well, you may end up getting a glug is generally more than a teaspoon. So you may well, let me ask you now a question. You know, I'm a doc, right? I play a doctor on the radio, at least. what happened to your cough? Did it help?
No. That's not helping. But it's only been a day or two, so.
But no, did the cough syrup help your cough at all?
Not very much.
Oh,
no.
Well, you know.
Anyway.
So, wait a minute. So what do you think about your doctor if the cough syrup didn't help your cough?
Oh, I love my doctor.
Next caller.
800-462-7413. The listeners will understand if I'm hacking and sniffling during the hour.
Right. 800-462-7413.
Now to the phone, Zorba. Our first caller is a listener in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you, Tom and Zorba. My wife and I listen to you guys often on the radio, so it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. Like to discuss back injury and a treatment option.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. Okay. So what's going on?
Okay, so I injured my back at the end of June. I had a couple bulge discs, and I also injured my SI joint as well, my sacroiliac joint. And initially I had a lot of back pain, and then I ended up having numbness and tingling down my right leg, and even to the point where I get it in my big toe as well. And since then I've done a lot of physical therapy, and that's helped me out immensely. I have now I have minimal back pain. Like I said, it's helped me out quite a bit, but it's not 100% quite yet.
Uh-huh.
And it's sitting for long periods of time.
Sure.
My SI joint can flare up. I get pain down to my knee and then uh-huh. even down into my big toe, even, you know, walking uh-huh. around. My main question is, so since this physical therapy has helped me quite a bit, I want to see if I can do something about the ligaments. And I've heard about this prolotherapy, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. Now, a lot of times I'm not in very much pain. It's just, I would say I get a flare-up, though, pretty much every day.
Sure. First of all, let's talk about what you're doing. You're doing the right stuff. After an injury, the most important thing you do is appropriate exercise, exercise, exercise. And that means with a physical therapist, at least initially, to show you what exercises are good, and then by yourself, maybe with a trainer. The ligaments do respond to exercise. Do they ever come back? Well, you're never going to be 21 again. And so you're not going to have that. You're never going to go back to 21, but you can improve your lot in life. And you are, as you said, 80 to 85% improved. And keeping it up will move that improvement even more. And, you know, so that's the main thing we do with the ligaments is the blood supply improves with exercise, the ligamentous stretch improves with exercise, and you're doing all that stuff. Now, prolotherapy is very interesting, not approved by insurance. And I'm not exactly sure why. It's a therapy that's been around for about 50 years, and there's some good studies that seem to show it works, and it's an injection into the ligaments with a solution that is made up of alcohol that reduces the inflammation of the ligaments. At least that's one of the theory, and then makes the ligaments stronger. Very good for acute pain, and whether it works in the long term and makes a difference, I'm not sure. So let me give you a perfect example. Me.
Mm-hmm.
I was, this a couple years ago, I was in Nepal. I was going to Nepal for 4 weeks, going to be off the grid for 4 weeks. I've got some SI joint pain. I've had it on and off since I injured myself on a fall with my trainer. My right SI joint, my good friend, Dr. Dan Barry, said, "You've got some SI joint pain. Let me do some prolotherapy on you." Came over to my house. Huge needle. I think it was about a foot and a half long. You know, rammed it into my back. No, he actually, you know, he took the surface, froze it a little bit, then put this needle right into the joint because he's trained in prolotherapy. Put it in there, and my joint pain was very good. Went away for about 12 weeks. It was very, very useful. And so it's useful to getting rid of the pain. I had no joint pain on my trip. About 12 weeks later, it came back. Is it better? Yes. Is it still there? Here it is. I injured myself 3-4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's still there. It's probably 5% of what it used to be. So Prolo can help kick it up, get rid of it for a while, I think, so you can exercise better. And for some people, it can be permanent, and for other people, it's temporary. So if you know somebody who does it and you want to pay for it, it can be expensive, it can be inexpensive. Find out what the cost is. You may want to try it. Exercise is going to be ultimately the best thing for your joints, though.
Okay.
So you're actually doing the right stuff. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Okay. Thank you much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. Thank you.
You know, very interesting thing. Prolo has been controversial, but I know a number of people who practice it, and they say it has worked well, certainly in the short run, and for some, a small percentage, mm-hmm. or maybe a medium percentage, it works in the long run.
Okay. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And before our next call, Zorba, let's talk about this change coming, maybe anyway, to nutrition labels.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting. First of all, the nutrition labels, I think, are frankly stupid. I mean, the ones that are
the
done.
Ones
I mean,
the
well, I could call them not untoward. I can call them difficult to decipher.
Yeah.
I could call them dumb, but I will call them stupid, which is sort of insulting. And the reason is nutrition labels are not good, but there's a tremendous amount of money on all sides of nutrition labels. It's not as simple as let's give consumers the best nutrition labels because manufacturers of industrialized food want to sell their product. So have you ever looked at the nutrition label of Dorito chips or any kind of chips?
I guess not, no.
Well, if you read it, it'll say, you know, how many calories are in 12 chips or 6 chips.
Don't they just say one serving
no.
usually?
Well, they say a serving. What's a serving? The serving might be 12 chips.
Yeah.
Well, who sits there and counts out 12 chips?
Right, right.
It should say how many servings in the bag, certainly in a small bag. And in a big bag, it ought to say, you know, half a bag, quarter of a bag.
But usually the number of the serving, the size of the serving is so much smaller than what we usually have.
You look at a typical soda that you buy in the store, it'll say how many calories in a serving, and it's 2 servings. Who drinks half a bottle of soda?
Yeah.
I mean, when you get a bottle of soda, you drink the entire bottle.
Sure.
But a serving might only be 10 ounces, and this is 20-ounce serving. So what they're doing now is they're duking it out. They're arguing whether or not it should be a better label that actually it makes sense to the size of the serving. I went the other day, went to Trader Joe's, one of my favorite places to shop, and I decided I was going to get shells and peas. I just felt like I needed some comfort food. I looked at the label quickly, didn't read it much, and it said like 150 calories, and I thought, well, that's pretty good. And then when I went, put it in the microwave, by the way, it wasn't as good as I thought it would be. The picture on the label was gourmet, but the stuff that came out was much closer to much closer to a TV dinner that I was used to. And it said, 150 calories, 2 servings in that particular thing. So I wasn't getting 150. I was getting 300.
300, yeah.
I was duped by the label.
Now, who eats half of a
half of a serving of shells and peas? So what they're talking about is making the serving size better. Also, they talk about the number of grams. Well, we don't really think in grams. So what they're going to talk about instead is whether or not it has whole grains in it. That's what we want to know. How many carbs are in it? Because we think in terms of carbs. How much fat is in it?
Yeah.
And they're looking at new labels. Now, the president can actually tell the FDA, we want to have this. It does not have to be an act of Congress. We've got the Dems on one side, the Republicans on the other side, the Libertarians on one side, the Progressives. You can actually scientifically look at it, and they can make it by executive order. However, there's a lot of money in this. We're going to see new labels. Let's hope they're good.
1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Doctor.
What's up?
I have a question about shingles. I have been plagued by recurring shingles for many, many years, and the last time I got them was about a month ago. I have a sister who also gets them quite often, and I mentioned it to her, and she said, well, I heard oatmeal can cause an eruption of shingles. And I went, what? Because I eat oatmeal, the steel-cut oats, in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, if she said something about lysine.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you ever heard this or you know anything about it.
No. And oatmeal does not. I want to lay one myth to rest.
Uh-huh.
That is a myth, that oatmeal or any other food will cause an eruption of shingles. That's not the case. I'll tell you what about shingles. Now, you had chicken pox when you were younger. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Everyone does.
Yes.
Everyone pretty much does. So the chickenpox virus, the varicella virus, is living in the nerve endings. It never, basically, the body fought it, developed antibodies, and it's sitting there waiting to erupt. And what happens is when our immunity goes down to that particular virus, it erupts, and so we have shingles. In other words, it's the virus that is just living there, and it's kind of throughout the body. And we don't really have a cure for this. Now, first of all, when you had any of these eruptions, did you ever get an antiviral medication to take?
I did recently, yes.
And how many days after the eruption did you take it? You remember it?
Oh, probably two.
Okay, so the goal is to take it within 72 hours after the eruption, and that is more likely to actually help the body get rid of shingles and probably reduce the chances that you're going to have recurrence for shingles. So have you had an eruption since that time?
No, just in the past month, and I took the...
You took the medication?
Yes.
Okay. A couple of things here. First of all, you may not get another eruption. That medication may have helped. My recommendation is, number one, call your doctor. Make sure you've got that medication on hand with you. In other words, in your shelf so you don't have to get it. Or you've got a recurrent prescription at your local pharmacy, which is a 24-hour pharmacy. And if you ever get another eruption again, you start on that medication ASAP. So you want to have that online, ready to go, 24 hours, you know, a pharmacy, whatever's located with you, so you know it'll be fresh. It's not going to sit on the shelf if it's more than a year or two. And you go to the pharmacy as soon as the eruption occurs, if that happens the next time. Number two, I would recommend the shingles shot. Have you ever had it?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And when did you have it? How long ago did you have it?
I think it was 2 years ago. Okay. I got it.
And so you've had that. For some people, the shingle shot may make a difference. For others, it will not. So that would be the second thing I would do. And frankly, that's about all we have to do. I mean, we want to just boost your immunity. And the antiviral medication might be actually what happened, and the shingle shot may have helped. And what do you take? Do you have pain when you have the eruption?
Yes, I take Aleve.
Aleve. Okay. There are two things you can do for pain. Gabapentin, which is a prescription drug, 300 milligrams three times a day, although it'll make you sleepy, is very effective for the pain of shingles. That's gabapentin. And when the sores heal, a lidocaine patch right on top of the shingles will be very useful. So you're doing the right stuff. And frankly, I love oatmeal, so keep on eating it.
I do too.
So you can eat it with impunity. Enjoy your breakfast.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. And Zorba, before we go, you ready to talk some more about oatmeal?
Yes!
This one comes from a listener, Mike in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, who asks, some time ago, I discovered that after 50-plus years of eating cooked oatmeal, that I enjoy eating it uncooked with cinnamon, berries, and soy milk. And I'm talking about old-fashioned, unprocessed oatmeal. Is there anything wrong with eating oatmeal like this? I've been eating it this way for a long time now, and I feel fine, and I don't have to deal with a messy pan afterwards. Could it be that by eating the oatmeal uncooked, I am not getting the benefit of all the nutrients?
No, you're absolutely fine. Sometimes cooking does increase the nutrients of some products.
Oh, really?
Very important with meat. Absolutely. Cooking, when you cook protein products, high protein products, meat, fish, or poultry, you actually make the body more it's easier for the body to absorb the protein that is heated than a protein often that is unheated.
But
in not in oatmeal at all. So there's nothing wrong. Basically, when you're heating it and cooking it, you're putting water into it. And so the answer is no. He can continue to eat the oatmeal just like that. I've never tried it uncooked.
I was just going to ask, have you ever tried
Have you ever tried it
uncooked? No, I haven't either.
Do you eat oatmeal?
Yeah, sometimes
I eat oatmeal. Now, I've got a question. Old-fashioned. You never see a package that says
right.
newfangled oatmeal.
Well, it's the only product that brags about being old.
That's right. Old-fashioned, right. New and improved, but not our oatmeal. It's old-fashioned oatmeal.
Well, brings us back to
to the day, warmth, mother, the whole thing.
Want Zorba to dish the raw facts? Just post your question to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe coming up. After the recipe, more of your calls, some more interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster too, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, recipe time, Zorba, tofu veggie stir fry.
I'm amazed that you could actually pronounce that name without getting ill or sick.
It's been a while since we had a tofu recipe.
I know. You know, we've stayed away from tofu.
And that's the good thing about this show.
No, but I thought about maybe highlighting one tofu recipe a month, just to sort of get us back in the habit of sort of accenting tofu and how good tofu is.
Give me something to gripe about.
There you go. So let's start out with 14 ounces of extra firm tofu.
14 ounces of extra firm tofu.
Now, did you know there were different kinds of tofu?
I found out years ago you don't remember this, when you had me actually eat tofu
on the radio. That's right, on the radio.
And, like a dope, I didn't realize that you had to actually prepare the... I got a package of tofu, brought it in, and tried to eat the tofu. Even a tofu lover can't just eat tofu.
Nobody just eats tofu. Now, I know there are some people who just eat tofu, but without anything at all, it's kind of... But they're different textures. And for cooking, you want to have extra firm tofu. Because you're going to be making this wrong.
What else?
4 tablespoonfuls of light soy sauce.
For big tea, light soy sauce.
Find the soy sauce that you like and light. And you might want to go to light low sodium soy sauce because soy sauce is filled with sodium. So I'd probably go to light low sodium soy sauce.
Yeah.
A tablespoonful of rice vinegar.
1 big tea rice vinegar.
A tablespoonful of fresh grated ginger.
A big tea grated fresh ginger.
Must be fresh.
Mm-hmm.
2 teaspoons of minced garlic.
2 little tea minced garlic.
Teaspoon of toasted sesame oil.
A little tea toasted sesame oil.
A sprinkle of crushed pepper.
Little crushed pepper.
That's right, little crushed pepper. 4 teaspoons of canola oil. You're going to sort of divide that up. We'll talk about that.
4 little tea canola oil.
You're kind of going to put this all in front of you, all these various recipes
doing
it. About 6 cups of assorted vegetables, broccoli, carrots, red peppers, green peppers, onions, whatever you want, whatever you have around the house.
6 cups assorted veggies.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about that. Perishables are good. Perishables are expensive.
Yeah.
The more perishables we eat, the better off we are.
Yeah.
The less perishables we eat, the worse off we are. So the real question is, what do you do with your perishables that are beginning to fade? Sometimes, you know, you want to do something with them. This is a good recipe to do that with.
Yeah.
In other words, because you're going to cook them, you're going to kind of move them around, you're going to add stuff to it. You know, you might have a pepper that is a little bit wilted that you don't want to put in a salad.
It's still going to taste good in here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with a faded vegetable that's in your refrigerator, and we want to use it. And some people stop buying perishables because they think they're going to waste them.
Yeah.
Smaller amounts of veggies that are in your refrigerator, you're still going to have perishables that are going to go to seed, if you will. And this is a good thing to use.
Yeah.
Okay, you're going to use some cornstarch, 2 teaspoons of cornstarch.
2 little tea cornstarch.
Okay, now you're going to use broth. Okay, use the broth of your choice, 3/4 of a cup. Now, if you are a strict vegetarian, use a veggie broth.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, I would use low-sodium chicken broth.
Yeah.
1.5 cups of hot cooked quinoa.
What's quinoa?
Well, quinoa is an ancient grain which they've used, I believe, in Peru and South America that has seen a resurgence in the U.S. And frankly, I find it a rather tasteless grain, but the texture is very interesting. So using it in a dish like this is going to really give it texture.
Got it. Cup
and a half of hot cooked quinoa. So follow the instructions for cooking the quinoa. And 1 teaspoon of sesame seeds toasted.
Mm-hmm. Little tea toasted sesame seeds.
Okay, so let's make it.
Yep.
So cut the tofu into 3/4-inch tubes. Place it in a shallow baking dish. Now, in a small bowl, whisk together the soy sauce, rice vinegar, ginger, garlic, sesame oil, and crushed red pepper. Pour it over the tofu and then cover and marinate it for at least 10 minutes. You can leave it there longer if you want to. The real issue is it's got to marinate. And then you drain, but you're going to reserve that marinade, so it's going to be marinated. Then, in a large skillet, heat 3 teaspoons of canola oil over medium-high heat. Then add the tofu to the skillet. Cook for about 3 minutes. Don't move it at all. It's going to begin to brown. Then use a spatula. Turn it over. Move it around in about 3 minutes more because the idea is not to move the tofu too much. Get that out of the skillet. Now, Take the remaining 1 teaspoon of canola oil with the assorted vegetables. Stir them up for about 2 to 3 minutes. Then add the cornstarch and water, which is going to then thicken the broth. You add that to the chicken broth or veggie broth. Whisk it into the marinated liquids. You're going to have liquid, you're going to have the broth, and you're going to have the cornstarch together. Add that to the skillet. It's going to firm up. Stir it. Put everything together. Put the tofu and the veggies together. Voila. And sprinkle with sesame seeds.
Yeah, actually, I've had tofu in it. It's pretty good if you have really good seasoning and a bunch of other nice things.
It has a number of ingredients, but for people who like to have quinoa and tofu and veggies, this is a dynamite recipe. And if you want to have the recipe, it's really easy. You can put it down on your smartphone. You can pull it off of our website at zorbapastor.org. You can put it on your PC or your Apple. You could even print it out. And if you go to zorbapastor.org, you will see photos of Tom, which everyone loves, and you'll see recipes.
How do I get the recipe if I don't have any of those things?
If you don't have any of those, you know what? It's going to be very difficult because we don't have an 800 number you can sign in. But if in your case, you could have Monica find us through Facebook, and she can pull down the recipe by going to Facebook.
She could do
getting
that.
Getting onto our website. So get somebody who can do that. That's zorbapastor.org. We are all over Facebook. Come visit us.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And our next caller, Zorba, is a listener in Sandy, Utah. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I have tinnitus, ringing of the ears, and have had it probably forever because I'm used to it. But I was wondering if there was anything that can be done to help it.
You've had it for 10 years, 20 years, 5 years? Keep going. So for a long time. It is a symptom of degenerative problems within the organ of corti, which is essentially the organ in the ear that where we appreciate sound. Mm-hmm. And it's a little thing that looks like a conch shell, practically. And when the little hairs don't work properly, these little hairs that move with liquid that's in there, then what happens is we get tinnitus or tinnitus. I've never been quite sure how to pronounce it. I am sure, since I've said that we'll get emails.
We'll find out.
Yes.
From the pronunciation police, please chime in on whether it's tinnitus or tinnitus and whether that's the proper English way or the American pronunciation.
Ringing of the ears.
Ringing of the ears we can pronounce with a surety. So, number one, you'll never get rid of it. It's not going to happen. So what we want to do is talk about what you do about it. So when does it bother you?
Probably mostly at night. Mm-hmm. I've had it so long, it's kind of, you know, an old friend.
No, it is. That's it's an old. No, it's a bad penny.
Okay. I do have white noise in the background, so that does.
And that's kind of part of it, is having white noise or something in the background. You know, white noise, it can be music or sound. Some people buy the sound meters that actually produce ocean sounds. Mm-hmm. And I was in a wonderful place. I was in Utah at a wonderful bed and breakfast in Moab, Utah. When I went to Utah Public Radio, they took me there and we went hiking. And in the room, there was a noisemaker, and you could put anything in. You could put in sounds of wind and sounds of water. I had the ocean sound, and I loved it until I went to sleep, and I noticed that I had to go to the bathroom. And every time I put on the ocean sound, when I came back, it made me want to urinate. So I discovered the ocean sound wasn't for me. But white noise of some sort or background noise is the way to go. And that's kind of the way to treat it. A lot of people have this, and they have it subclinically, so they put the radio or TV in the background, and then our mind attends to that and stops attending to the white noise. I mean, to the tinnitus. So, and it usually bothers people when it's late at night and they're trying to go to sleep. Yeah. Does it keep you awake?
No, it doesn't. But occasionally during the day, I'll get a really big ring.
Right.
Where did that come from?
Yeah. Well, and it comes from these sounds from the hair cells, the little hair cells in the organ of corti, which are just not responding properly. We all have this to some extent when we get a cold, when we have an upper respiratory infection, and the eustachian tube between our nose and it just plugs up, and we all tend to get it, and it, you know, where we have kind of this ringing in the ears, and that can be a sign of a cold, sore throat, allergies, and sinuses. So I'm afraid you're not going to get rid of your old friend.
My bad penny. Yeah, you do learn to live with something like this.
Yes, you do. And for some people, it's more bothersome than others. And as I said, the treatment essentially is to have something in the background where your brain attends to it. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Now, Zorba, maybe I didn't have real tinnitus, but years ago, I had ringing in my ears for maybe a couple of years.
Yeah. I have tinnitus. Sometimes it bothers me. Sometimes it doesn't. I have more during allergy season because when I'm more plugged up, I really have it when I have a cold or a sore throat.
Mm-hmm.
But often in my house, when I'm in the house alone especially and there's nothing going on, I have to have something in the background. And my choice isn't white noise. My choice is public radio.
Now, are you telling the truth?
You mean, was that a setup for a commercial for public radio? I'll let you decide.
800-462-7413. And on we go now, Zorba, to a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. My question is that I am a type 2 diabetic. I was diagnosed about 10 years ago. I'm about 60 now. And it's well controlled using Janumet and exercise. I've been reading about some claims of a connection between Janumet and pancreatic cancer. And I'm also aware of some studies linking aspartame and pancreatic cancer. And my question is, have the studies of Janumet and aspartame separated out those two user groups into distinct subject studies?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any reliable data that shows that aspartame, which is NutraSweet, causes pancreatic cancer, period. You go to the internet on NutraSweet and you will see myth after myth after myth after myth perpetrated. It's been around for a long time. It doesn't cause pancreatic cancer. There is
because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true.
There you go. Just like in the newspapers, it doesn't mean it's true. That's exactly it. Now, the issues that have to do with diabetes. First of all, your diabetes is very well controlled. And in fact, 5.2 to 5.7 is about as strict as you can be. So are you having any hypoglycemic episodes? That's my first question. Do you have any low blood sugar episodes?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, you would be aware of, because if you are, your control is too tight. So I just want to put that back to you. In other words, we used to think, until pretty recently, that the tighter control, the better off you are. And then there was a number of studies, one of the studies called the Acorn study, that showed that if you have control that is super tight, like you have, 5.2 to 5.7 hemoglobin A1C, that's a number, that's a batting average of blood sugar, and you're having any hypo or low blood sugar episodes, then that is too tight, and you should actually pull back on some of your medications. I'm more concerned about the tightness of the diabetes, these long-term studies that have shown that super tight control is actually not good. So I just want to mention that. If you're not having any hypoglycemic episodes, you're fine. Now, as for the link, there's a link. There have been a couple of interesting links with diabetic medications. Janumet are two medications. Metformin, no link with that and cancer, but a link with something called lactic acidosis in a rare case. But that drug is now widely used. And the other drug is Januvia. Januvia is kind of an insulin sensitizer. That's not exactly what it does, but it changes how the body receives blood sugar. And there have been some questions with all of these of whether or not they're linked to either bladder cancer, the drug Actos might have a link with that, and pancreatic cancer. These are very, very weak links. There's nothing strong there yet. The FDA has said they're weak links. We don't think that the link is really there. May it be there? Maybe. And I think it's if I were to look at a 1 to 5 scale and I would look at the evidence, I would call it a 1. In other words, I'm not really concerned about it. And I prescribe that drug all the time because I think it's a good drug. And I think the risk of heart attacks from diabetes and the risk of the complications of diabetes and death from diabetes are far worse and far more than the risk of cancer. We worry about cancer more than we worry about heart disease, and yet we are probably 5 to 10 times more likely. You are 5 to 10 times more likely to die at your age of a heart attack than you are from cancer.
That makes me feel a lot better about taking the Janumet.
Yeah. I would definitely stand it. And once again, just a little bit, let me sort of rattle on about the cancer issue. You know, the big C people look at and they go, I don't want to take this because I'm worried about cancer. Cancer worries us because we look at people failing. We think about the pain. We see them wasting away. And yet a good friend of mine who's a doctor in Wisconsin recently died. He was mid-60s, 66, 67, healthy guy, exercised right, ate right, on his way to the islands on a vacation, a mover and shaker in Madison, world-renowned researcher, had chest pain. He was in New York in a hotel. He had chest pain, told his wife to call the EMS. EMS was called. They arrived there. As they were putting him in the gurney, he arrested. They shocked him, brought him out of the arrest, so he had good medical care. Trauma center was 5 minutes away, was on the way to the trauma center with good EMTs, you know, in New York, arrested again. They worked on him for 45 minutes and were never able to bring him back. You know, so he was, and he had great medical care. He didn't appear to have any problem at all. He just died of a heart attack. And, you know, we can say, well, it was his time to go. And the answer was he had silent heart disease that had no symptoms
so
at all.
Your point is we should worry about that. And
we ought to worry much more about heart disease. Yeah. Worry about cancer with this. Diabetics are much more likely to have heart disease. Do all the heart disease stuff and take this rare possibility of cancer and put it in the back of your mind. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I appreciate the information.
Yeah, thank you again. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's dive into the inbox and take a question from a concerned listener, David, in East Tennessee. He asks, "Hey, Doc and Tom, I am a 57-year-old single male and have been diagnosed with hypocitraturia with calcium oxalate stones. I've already had the stones blasted from both kidneys. However, my urologist suggests that I stay away from some of my favorite foods, spinach, carrots, green beans, berries, nuts, yogurt, chocolate, sweet potatoes, and sweet tea, and I should also limit sodium and animal proteins. I am at a loss on what to eat. Do you have any advice or information you could offer me? Thanks in advance."
Yes, well, certainly it's hard to figure out what to eat when you're in a diet like that. So hypocitruria basically means low citrate in the urine, and it's a metabolic disturbance that is more likely to be associated with kidney stones. Most kidney stones are calcium, 90, 95% are calcium. And for the most part, we can't do much about it. But in a case like this where you're producing less citrate, often a low-sodium diet is recommended. Well, we all eat too much sodium in our society, or most of us, so that's really important. And then there are a variety of other diets that are also recommended to try to basically make sure that you sort of improve this metabolic state. Some of them get rid of fruit. Some of them get rid of fruit and chocolate. What I think I would do is I'd go to the web, look up the various diets for your particular malady, and see whether or not it makes a difference. From what I've read of the literature, the diets may make a difference, but some studies show they don't make as much of a difference as we think they do. What does make a difference, though, is staying hydrated, making sure that you have enough fluid so that your kidneys, if you will, are not sluggish, and that's especially important in the summer when it's hot.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, our medical MythBuster 2, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk about caramel coloring, the chemical they say is linked to cancer. This is the coloring in soda pop.
That's right. Well, first of all, if it was really caramel coloring, do you think it would be linked to cancer? I mean, don't you think of caramels of when you eat caramels, right?
Yeah.
You know, those wonderful brown little sugary things that sort of melt in your mouth. But yeah. That's not what it is. It's coloring made to look like caramel, and it's actually a substance called 4-methyllimidazole, or 4-MEL.
Yeah.
And basically, Consumer Reports did a little analysis of this because the feds have looked. The California office, for instance, the State Office of Environmental Hazard Assessment has said 4-MEL, which is what this is, may be linked, possibly be linked to cancer. And it may be that you have to, you know, get rid of it or put it on the label. Well, Consumer Reports took a whole bunch of cans of soda, and they looked at the level of this and discovered that some sodas had very high levels. For example, Pepsi One had a very high level. Well, that's an issue, but so did other sodas like Whole Foods, 365 everyday value soda. Whole Foods is like the pristine place. Their level was over the top. It was actually about just as high, if not higher, than the Pepsi One when they first analyzed it. When they analyzed it several months later, they found they had dropped it from roughly 60 to the number 10. In other words, they actually had taken that out of their
soda. They changed the product.
Correct. Correct. So I think there's this is
Pepsi,
very interesting.
By the way, says that there's nothing wrong with their soda and that they're that,
right,
fine.
Right. They say there's nothing, and they may indeed be correct. You know, some of this stuff is very, it's way off in the side, and these things don't cause cancer. But I remember when I was a child, when red dye number 2 was taken off the market. I remember all the hot dogs in Chicago were great; they were bright red.
Yeah.
When you boiled the hot dogs, you remember they would be red in the water, especially the kosher hot dogs. Then they took it off, and they were kind of dull and ugly.
That was a real danger.
That was a real danger. So the question is this a real danger, or are we simply looking at something that is not a real danger? And I think when we look at any industrialized products, we have to think about that. Soda is an industrialized food. It is not natural. If you're worried that the chemicals in soda may be actually causing you cancer, stop drinking soda. I think it's really pretty easy.
Yeah. What they should do is make them put 4-methyllimidazole on their label.
And let's see what happens. That's right. That's right. Colored with 4-methyllimidazole on it. And I bet the Pepsi One and the stuff from Whole Foods would actually drop. And that's, of course, what it is. You know, the goal of industrialized food is to sell the product to us. But on the other hand, we've got to make sure they're safe. This will continue in the future.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. And before our next call, Zorba, time once again for our medical MythBuster. Today's myth comes to us from Steve of Plymouth, Minnesota. He writes, "Hello, good doctor. I recently returned from a trip to South Padre Island. While jogging along the beach there, I stepped on a jellyfish that was beached along the shoreline. My wife was quick to suggest that the best way to relieve the stinging pain was to urinate on my feet. Funny enough, I didn't have to go at the time, so I decided to guzzle some water and wait. Finally, I unleashed a powerful stream upon my throbbing feet." Too graphic. "And waited for
TMI,
relief."
TMI.
"Yeah, but no relief came. My feet are fine now, but I couldn't help but wonder, is this jellyfish remedy actually a myth?"
You know, I think it's actually a myth. But the real question was, if he couldn't urinate, what about his wife?
Oh.
Sorry. Sorry.
Yeah.
Teenage humor.
So this is a myth?
Well, I think basically washing off the toxin as quickly as you can is really what you want to do. That's ultimately what happens. So going in the water,
running in the
trying
water
to get the toxin,
be better,
that's actually very good. And drinking, you know, drinking some water and waiting for your kidneys to actually produce the urine and then urinating on your feet, I don't think is really the way to go. I think it's getting rid of the toxin. And I didn't mean to disrespect his wife by saying that she could have stepped in, but I think basically it was the water issue.
Well, if you want to send your myth to Zorba, you're in luck. Just send it along in an email to...
You're in luck because I'm going to give you the address. Zorba@WPR.org. Or don't forget, just come and find us through Facebook. And that will be good luck for you, too. Good luck.
800-462-7413. And to the phones again now, Zorba, with a listener in Mankato, Minnesota. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question regarding mattresses and upholstered furniture in general. I've been sleeping on a Tempur-Pedic pillow for 15 years, and just recently in November I purchased a Tempur-Pedic mattress.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after purchasing that mattress, I saw a couple of different articles in the local Minneapolis paper and the New York Times about chemicals in mattresses. The chemicals are added for flame retardant. And according to different sources, including Toxic Hot Seat, an HBO documentary, there are problems with these chemicals that they put in mattresses that they can be hazardous to your health. And the law has changed so that mattress manufacturers can take that out of their mattresses and such. My question to Dr. Zorba would be, has he heard of this? And if so, what his take on this is, because I'm getting no information from the mattress manufacturer or my local dealer. They're saying that they don't know anything about it.
Sure, of course. What else would they say? What else would they say? First of all,
right.
How do you like your mattress?
Well, I like my mattress a lot,
mm-hmm.
but it makes me nervous to think that I'm sleeping on something that, as it breaks down, will release dust that has chemicals
in it and
will go into my body.
Yeah, that then kills you. Well, let's look at this from the beginning. First of all, you know, the reason that manufacturers put flame retardants in mattresses is because a lot of people die from when they're in bed sleeping and their mattress catches fire, specifically people who smoke cigarettes in bed. You know, they're in bed, they smoke a cigarette,
mm-hmm.
And most smokers smoke in bed. You know, many, 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 many smokers. I don't know if it's 50% or 75%. They have a smoke before they go to sleep. They fall asleep. It goes in the bed, and it's responsible for a lot of fires. Last time I looked, it was something like 10 or 15%, maybe 20% of house fires are from smokers smoking in bed. It's not a small amount. It's a large amount.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if there's a fire in your house, you've got the mattress catching on fire, trying to get off the mattress. So there's a huge movement towards flame retardant chemicals and flame retardant pajamas for children. That was the big issue. And so a number of years ago, manufacturers started taking some of the chemicals out of flame retardant pajamas for children that the feds wanted them to put in because they said the chemicals may be causing more problems,
yeah.
You know, than the risk of actually a pajama catching on fire. And now basically they're looking now towards the chemicals in mattresses to see what this is. So we've got to look at from a risk point of view. So number one, do you smoke cigarettes?
No.
Okay. half the smokers die from, they lose about 10 years of life because they smoke, either from heart attacks or stroke or heart disease. You don't smoke cigarettes. Do you have a job outside the house?
Yes.
And what kind of a job is it? Is it in a dangerous place?
No, there's no hazardous chemicals around me or anything like
that.
Okay,
so no hazardous chemicals. How long does it take? How do you commute to work?
In my car, it takes me about 5 minutes.
Okay, so 5 minutes. So you don't have a long commute. And the reason why I ask that, the longer commute, the greater the risk of death that you're going to die in a car because you're spending, you're spending more hours on the road. So you've got to look at this from a risk reduction point of view. You put on your seatbelt to make sure if you get into a car accident. I've been putting on my seatbelt, I think I calculated 100,000 times. I have yet to get into an accident. Was that a dumb thing to do? And the answer is no.
Well,
the accident may actually, happen one day. I never know when it's going to happen. But the risk that you're going to get cancer from some chemical that may be in the mattress is a very small risk. Very small risk. It may be zero. It may be close to zero. But it's a very, very small risk. And I don't think I'd be concerned. And also, these chemicals, although they're in the mattress over time, you've already been on that mattress for years. So most of the chemicals in there that might be dust that have come away have actually come out of the mattress. But the feds have been very, very nonspecific on this, which means to me the risk is tiny at this particular time. So I don't think I would change mattresses unless I really became very upset about it. And if I liked my mattress, I would stay with it. And I've looked at this. I've got a mattress that's 10 years old. I'm sure it's flame retardant. And I sleep on it every night. And I have no plans on changing mine. Does that put it into perspective? Some of these risks are teeny tiny, and we're concerned about them. The kids' pajamas, though, were a different issue because they're the children, and the skin was right on the pajama, and they were walking around with these chemicals that were newly manufactured, and they were absorbing it, and that became a different issue.
Okay, so like with the bedding store, they told me to protect myself, I should make sure I have a mattress cover on the bed so that it doesn't come out. So would that be...
That would definitely reduce the risk. If you get a plastic cover and you put it on the mattress, so the plastic cover is there, that's going to reduce anything that's coming out of the mattress. They are 100% correct. Did they have covers to sell you?
I'll bet.
Yeah, it came, I got a cover for it.
Yeah.
It's not plastic, it's made out of material.
Uh-huh, good. How much was it, if I may ask?
Well, it came as a package deal. I paid like $5,300 for the whole set.
Uh-huh.
So it was very expensive.
It was very expensive. Well, but then you've reduced it, and if that gives you peace of mind when you sleep at night, that's what's worthwhile.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And before we head out, Zorba, let's hear from the real sticklers of the Zorba Task Force, the Syrup Police. This week's correction comes from a loyal listener, Pam. She writes, "Dear Zorba, I love your show, but I recently heard you say that Karo syrup is high fructose corn syrup. So I looked in my cupboard and my bottle of Karo syrup says on the label, 0% high fructose corn syrup. And the ingredients listed is corn syrup." they are totally different things. Please correct this.
Well, they're both derived from corn, and I think we'll just leave it at that. One is high fructose corn syrup. The other is corn syrup. They're both from corn. They're both sweet, and I think we will let the listeners decide what, if any, difference actually exists other than in the word high.
If you'd like to surreptitiously correct Zorba,
I love your
grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or through Facebook.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Or you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0208Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.